Well, folks, welcome to one more edition of Politics Unwrapped. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Thank you so kindly for being a part of the show. We are going to have a great show for you today. Now, I can't put that little piece of the show on the screen that I used to where I have my giant screen in the studio, but we have a lot to talk about today. We have a great professor that's going to talk about treason. But beforehand, there are two things I want to talk about. One is what Lindsey Graham been doing as far as trying to get Georgia, Arizona, and other places where have mail-in ballots to somehow throw ballots out. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we're going to talk about Medicare for All. I want to, you know, going through the medical tribulations that I've been going through my entire life. And now with my young daughter, some issues that I actually see, I want to see if we can get engaged with people on all sides of this issue and let folks understand that this is not really an ideological issue. This is an issue of humanity. So we're going to talk about those two issues at first, and then we're going to move on into the what the professor has to say. Now, as we spoke, I forgot to go ahead and cue a few of my things here. So as we speak right now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and cue some values. Welcome aboard, Bridge MCP. Let's see. Welcome aboard, Michael Rudnan. Welcome aboard all my peeps that are out here. Thank you so kindly for being here. Please remember, one of the first things that we ask you to do so kindly is to please, please, please share. That is how we are going to make a difference. That is how we actually get things done. A lot of people don't realize that unless we do these things, the mainstream media, look, I give the mainstream media a hard time. I do. But the people that comprise the mainstream media, they're not bad people. These are reporters that went to college. They went to school. Some of them did, some of them didn't. But they are, in general, they also want to do a good thing. Why aren't they necessarily always doing a good thing? Well, folks, it's because of the system that we have here. The system does not lend itself to people doing the right thing. I mean, after all, these people have to go ahead and survive. And how do they think they survive? They survive by selling advertising. And who are the people that supply these advertising for these people? Again, the corporate America. And who's it that's trying to control us? Who's it that's making things as difficult as they are for us right now? That is as well the corporate America. So I tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to start by giving out the title of the show. The title of the show today is Professor Carlton Larson on Treason. Fascist Lindsey Graham want Georgia to dump votes and we must push Medicare for All. I'm going to start the show today with the little piece that I did on, with the little cutout that I did from Lindsey Graham. I want you guys to think about that. Republicans are always, and when I'm talking about Republicans, I'm not talking about my Republican brothers and sisters. I'm talking about Republican politicians who try to provide angst to their people by telling them somehow somebody is trying to scam them. Somebody is trying to take their votes. Somebody is trying to do all these things. Of course, we know those things are all false. They're all false. But when we actually look into it, when we look into North Carolina, guess who actually tried to steal an election in North Carolina? It wasn't Democrats. It was Republicans trying to steal an election. Republican politicians, Republican operatives, they were trying to steal an election in California, in North Carolina. Think about that. So as they continue to talk these issues about, oh, somebody is trying to steal an election, remember who actually does those things. It's not, I have yet to see in recent times at least, where Democrats somehow were responsible for attempting to or stealing elections. That has not been the case at all. I'm going to take a look at what you're saying in a little bit as I get some of these things here queued. Let's go ahead and let me go ahead and cue a few of these things, and then we'll go ahead and get a little bit busy further on with what we're doing here. But anyhow, let's go ahead and share that. I need to go ahead and share to our main page, and then we'll get busy with one of the where is that more options? and we can go to our main page and go ahead and, oops, not wrong one, wrong one, wrong one, wrong one. I'm coming to you guys right now, but I got to go ahead and share this baby, and I will be sharing right now. Share to that page, and now I got the page that I want to share to, and it is now officially shared. Okay, let's go ahead and listen to what Lindsey Graham had to say, and then we'll move it on at the other side. This is Lindsey Graham. Check this out.
And now claims from Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, who says Senator Lindsey Graham called him up and suggested that legally cast mail ballots in some counties be thrown out.
Senator Graham applied for us to audit the envelopes and then throw out the ballots for counties who had the highest frequency error of signatures.
Was there a moment in the call where you said, I'm sorry, Mr. Senator, but what you're asking me to do or suggesting I should do is not up to me and is not right morally, legally, or otherwise?
I really just got off the call and I said I would circle back.
Go back for a second, though, to Lindsey Graham. I mean, how long are we going to continue to call this guy a patriot? I mean, he's sitting here trying to collude and trying to find ways to get rid of legally cast ballots. And it doesn't matter whether it's for the presidential or the Senate race. No, that's what people do in dictatorships. That's what people do in authoritarian states, not in the United States of America. And it's just absolutely ridiculous for whatever reason he's doing it, that he's out there trying to do it. And the fact that a fellow Republican called him out on it, I think, is heartening. And hopefully the Republicans will follow Michael's good leadership here and stop playing politics and help the country unite after a brutal campaign.
Shame on Lindsey Graham. Shame on Lindsey Graham altogether. If you take a look at how things are going, it is a shame that he did that. Now, ask yourself this question. I want you to really do some deep thinking here. Make believe that this was actually a Democrat that called up into Pennsylvania, that called up into New York, California, and all these other states. And think about what the response would be from Republicans if this had actually occurred. Think about that. And then the other question that you have to ask yourself, why is a South Carolina senator, why is a South Carolina senator calling into Georgia, calling into Arizona and all these places and asking these guys about their election process? It's none of his business. Why is he doing that? So there's a whole lot of these issues to discuss. But anyhow, let's, without further ado, go ahead and get started with the professor. The professor has a lot to say. Let's go ahead and get started, and then we'll move on the other side. Welcome to one more edition of Politics Unwritten. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Thank you so kindly for being with us. We have a special guest with us today. Carlton F.W. Larson is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis School of Law, where he teaches American constitutional law and English and American legal history. A graduate of Harvard College and Yale Law School, Larson is one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason, a word we've heard a lot lately. Larson is the author of the recently released book On Treason. What is the sound?
Yeah.
Welcome to one more edition of Politics Done Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Thank you so kindly for being with us. We have a special guest with us today. Carlton F.W. Larson is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis School of Law, where he teaches American constitutional law and English and American legal history. A graduate of Harvard College and Yale Law School, Larson is one of the nation's leading authorities on the law of treason, a word we've heard a lot lately. Larson is the author of the recently released book, On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. Welcome to Politics Done Right. Carlton, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me here. Happy to be here.
Well, look, we really wanted to get into this topic because it's a word that's being used loosely all over. Anything somebody says that in the body politic that you don't like, it makes you a traitor. So, but before we get into that, because of the recent election and what's going on, all our guests here at Politics Done Right, I ask them for their impression of what just occurred in this country. So why don't you give me your TikTok on the just passed election?
Well, I mean, I think this is an election where everybody in America can come away disappointed. You know, if you're a Republican, you just lost the presidency in one of the biggest blowouts of an incumbent president in our history. And if you're a Democrat, you had hopes that the win would have been a lot bigger. You had hopes of taking the Senate and of gaining House seats, none of which happened. And I think, you know, the reality is that this is a great big country that is pretty evenly divided. And we have to be able to live with each other. And that's a challenge, and it gets harder all the time.
Now, some other disappointments. We didn't win any houses, which means we'll be on the bad side of redistricting again, since this is a census year and it'll affect redistricting. So there are, you know, I really don't think we did near as well as we would have wanted to do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, everybody really pinned 2020 as the key year for fixing the redistricting problem. And it's probably going to be better than it was in 2010, but it's certainly nowhere near what it might have been. And certainly, you know, the Supreme Court decision on gerrymandering didn't help at all, and that's obviously, you know, totally gone now with the court.
As a constitutional scholar, is there anything that we can do, given that, in my humble opinion, I'm not a constitutionalist, I'm not a lawyer, but in my humble opinion, it seems to me that redistricting is against democracy, or that the way we set up districting is anti-democratic. Is there anything constitutionally that we could use to point that out? Because I think it's quite evident.
Well, I think, you know, the redistricting is a real problem, and a big part of the problem just is geographic concentration, and that is that Democrats tend to be concentrated in urban areas. Republicans tend to be spread out a little bit more. So even if you drew the lines in sort of a perfectly fair, seemingly neutral manner, you would inevitably advantage Republicans in disfavor Democrats by creating districts that are very heavily stacked with Democrats. I mean, an extreme solution would be actually to get rid of districts entirely. It's not required under the Constitution that U.S. House seats be allocated on the basis of districts. There's a federal statute that requires that, but that statute could in theory be repealed, and you could make all of the House seats at large in a particular state. Now, there's obviously downsides to doing that. You lose the close connection with constituents, and there's questions of how you would actually structure that election. But in theory, that could be done. And if the gerrymandering problem continues to persist, that may be something that ought to be looked at.
Oh, you know, I am so happy that you said that. I had no clue. I thought that's in as much as I've read the entire Constitution, for some reason that districting have been baked in. Now, if they decided to do that, you remove that from the law, that it reverts back to state law as far as how they allocate those Congress people, correct?
Yeah, and so in the very early years, some states did their representatives at large, and some did it by districts. And I believe it was about the 1840s that Congress required the districts. But yes, that could be repealed.
Now, interesting. Now, when it comes to the election proper, you mentioned something that's quite interesting. You said evenly divided country. It's scary to me. That statement to me is scary. And the reason why is I would hate to believe that the 72 million or so people that voted for Donald Trump really believe in the tenets of Donald Trump, as opposed to just being red-blooded Republicans who vote the party line. Which one do you think it is? Because it's a significant difference if most of these people are Trumpists as opposed to just Republican ideologues. Very big difference.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't certainly have any expertise on analyzing Republican voters. We do know that a large number of Republican voters voted against Trump and then voted for Republican members of the Senate and the House. And so the ones who voted a straight ticket presumably are more committed to the Republican Party. I mean, my guess is, I mean, Trump is so distinctive as a personality that it's very sort of hard to make generalizations about what's going on and what's going to happen going forward, to what extent what we call Trumpism has any legs beyond the sort of unique person of Donald Trump. I mean, can some other Republican embody those things? It's sort of hard to imagine, you know, who the next Donald Trump might be.
It is also scary that somebody with that limited intellect, that limited vocabulary, that limited empathy, that limited just being, that limited having any sort of humanity could get such a fallen. Does that tell you something about the America that you were born into?
Well, it doesn't make one thrill. That's for sure. You know, the 2016 election, I think a lot of people didn't like Hillary Clinton. They didn't like Donald Trump. And they ended up thinking, well, Hillary Clinton maybe represents more of the same. Donald Trump is at least something different. We can roll the dice and see if we get a, you know, maybe something different. And so, you know, some of it was just they didn't like Hillary.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in my humble opinion, I think that when they had to choose between two people that they didn't like, that they chose Trump. I think it goes right back into the thing about how much does sexism play a role in America, not only from a male point of view, but also from a female point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was in fourth grade, Walter Mondale had picked Geraldine Ferraro as his mm-hmm. running mate. And I was the only person in my class who supported Walter Mondale. And the teacher, we had a substitute teacher, a woman, and she told the whole class that we should all support Reagan because Mondale had picked a woman. And a woman shouldn't be the vice president. You know, and this was told to me in a public elementary school, you know, back in 1984. And so I think there is sort of a deep entrenched sexism. And it's not just men who have some of those views.
You know, I'm so happy that you told that story. That alone makes a hell of a informative clip, because many people throw this trope solely on men. And unfortunately, it's a sort of indoctrination that applies to us all. Now, Carlton, let me first say thank you for writing that book. Like I said, I didn't read the entire book, but the pieces that I've read of the book and the kudos that I've gotten about the book, it is definitely needed right now. So why did you write this book at this time? Treason has been something that we've been throwing around for some time.
Yeah, so I've been interested in treason for a long time. I actually wrote my college thesis on it in the mid-1990s, and then started working on a sort of substantive book about treason in the American Revolution, which came out last year, called The Trials of Allegiance, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution. And as a result of that work and some of my other writing on treason, I became known as somebody who knows a little bit about this. And so when the media had questions about treason law, they would reach out to me. Now, that didn't happen much, you know, because for most of my career,
right,
the phone was pretty quiet. Well,
Donald Trump.
Yeah, and then along came Donald Trump, and then, you know, pretty soon I started getting these calls. You know, he called on Russia to hack the DNC. There's this Michael Flynn business. There's all of this stuff going on. What's happening? And so I started getting all these calls. Sometimes, you know, I could tell the story would break, and I'd get, you know, 2-3 calls that day asking whether or not this is treason. And, you know, this is extraordinary. People want to know, did the President of the United States commit treason, the highest crime known to the law? And so that was really bizarre. And at the time, my literary agent said, well, you know, you should write, you've been doing this big book on the revolution, why don't you write a shorter book just for a broader audience about what treason is all about? And then, no, I don't want to do that. I'm too busy. I got all this other stuff going on. But then, you know, there's more and more news. All of a sudden, everybody's talking about treason, which is the subject I've devoted much of my life to. It's like, well, if not now, when? You know, this is the time for
it's
it.
The moment.
And so I said, okay, I'll write this up and kind of put out what I know about the subject in a way that, you know, hopefully non-lawyers can easily understand.
Now, that is so important, that the magical last sentence in a form that non-lawyers can understand, because I can tell you a lot of times these things are so lawyerly that for most of us it is difficult to understand. Now, in short and long, why don't you define what exactly is treason?
Sure. So as a general term, treason is betrayal of a country. And pretty much every nation in the world has some type of treason law. America is distinctive in that treason is actually defined in our Constitution in Article 3, and it's limited to levying war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And so that means Congress can't, you know, simply define treason as something else. We're stuck with that constitutional definition. And so all of the framework of treason law really operates around that constitutional framework.
Now, in your book, you wrote the following, and this is a reason why I think for me, and I think for many, it is rather complicated. And in our non-lawyerly minds, Donald Trump has committed treason several times over. So I'd like you to tell me why we're wrong. It says, according to your book, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Here's the deal. Treason is levying war against them. Who? Against the American people. Is that correct?
Against the United States, yes.
Right. Now, let me just go off the wall here. We have a virus that is attacking the United States right now, and it is the responsibility of the government to provide for our welfare. Now, wouldn't one consider levying war that which causes the death of many of your citizens en masse?
No. So levying war really requires, you know, the use of armed force in an attempt to overthrow the government. And so it doesn't apply to just general incompetence, which I think is a fair description of how the Trump administration has handled this virus.
Now, let me expand on that a little bit, because you said it's not mere incompetence that's the driving force here, but could we also say if Donald Trump's intent on having us infected en masse would result, but the purpose of that is to ingratiate himself, let's say, with Russia? Would that be treason if it could be somehow proven in a telephone call that he made to somebody and says, hey, let's not do that because we can make a deal here?
That too would not be treason. And this is one of those areas of treason law where I think the law and popular conceptions are the most divergent.
Right.
And that is because, you know, if you sell out the nation to Russia, how could that not be treason, right? Or you sell out the nation to China, it seems like it would have to be treason. But it's actually not. And that is simply aiding a foreign country isn't treason. It has to be aid to an enemy. And an enemy is pretty clearly defined as a foreign nation or group with whom we are in a state of open war. That is, so it's clear that, you know, we are fighting them. That if we catch them, they are enemy combatants, that we imprison them, that if we see their planes, we shoot them down, right? That we're in actual open war. And we're just not in a state of open war with Russia. And so that means anything you could potentially do to aid Russia isn't technically treason. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a crime. And I think that's very important, because a lot of people think, well, it's not treason, that means it's okay, go ahead and do it. Absolutely not.
Okay.
There are a whole range of other national security laws other than treason that deal with problems of disloyalty. One of them would be espionage, of course. So if you hand secrets over to Russia, you're going to be guilty of espionage. And probably the best example of that is the Rosenbergs in the early 1950s, who handed nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. Well, we weren't technically at war with the Soviet Union, so they couldn't be tried for treason. But they were prosecuted for espionage and executed. And so, yes, it wasn't technically treason, but as I say in the book, that probably didn't give them a great deal of comfort as they were being strapped into the electric chair. You know, I mean, we still got them for a very serious crime.
Now, how does America experience their experience with treason law over the past 250 years help explain the country's history?
Well, our country was actually founded in an act of treason against Great Britain. That is that, you know, we chose to rebel and we were levying war against the king. And that was pretty clear treason. All of our what we call, you know, founding fathers. I don't really like that term, but those folks, they were all traitors, and they were willing to roll the dice and see if they would win. And it turned out they did. You know, and then if you think about our Civil War, that was the biggest act of treason in our history, right? I mean, the Confederate States of America were very clearly levying war against the United States. So it's the absolutely central theme, in some ways, of the two most pivotal moments of our history.
Professor, I have interviewed so many people over the years, and nobody has really, none of the people, I don't know if they're out there, none of the people that I've had on my interviews had the gall to say what you just said. What you just said was profound. And actually, it should also provide many people in this country a certain degree of humility. What you just spoke about, the founding fathers, that was, in fact, yes, an act of treason. And we can go through time and time again when that has happened. And we have made many other, in authorizing many Americans that have never attempted to overthrow this country other than coming here and attempting to get a job. We have put that trope on so many when most of the times these sort of things occurred was out of any kind of purview of those people. So what do you say to that? I'm impressed. Not many people would ever say what you just said.
Well, I mean, that's what the history is, you know? It's and, you know, from our perspective, it's odd to think of George Washington as a traitor, but from the British perspective, that's exactly what he was. And if Britain had won the revolution, and it was a close call. I mean, there were numerous times militarily where that whole thing could have gone the wrong way quite quickly. And then Britain would have had to decide, well, what do we do? You know, do we hang this guy or what?
I mean, given your honesty, I'm going to deviate from your book a tad bit because I want to hear from an expert, somebody who talks like you do. Right now, we have several movements in this country. We have the Black Lives Matter movement, and we have many other progressive movements that are always under attack as possibly being treasonous, based on your definition, of course, not in necessarily. But it seemed to me that while many people would use the Founding Fathers for reasons why we should do things constitutionally and peacefully, it seems to me that, and by the way, we know how we operate overseas when we don't get what we want. It seems to me a bit hypocritical to throw this on these guys who have not ever attempted to overthrow the country, but just say we want equity, to put them in that domain, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the charge of treason against people who are protesting the government, I mean, that's something that the revolutionary generation would have understood very deeply, because it clearly was treason once they started the war in April 1775, there's no question. But they were tarred as traitors well before that for protesting British tax policies. And they said, no, that can't be right. We're simply asserting our rights under the British Empire. And that's not treason. It's not treason to, you know, proclaim what our rights should be. And the British government threatened to send these people to England for trial, haul them away from North America, so there's no local jury, and try them for treason in England. And that was an absolute motivating factor leading to the War for Independence and for the Declaration of Independence, that treason would be abused to essentially harm innocent political protesters who simply are trying to make things work. And if you remember, they had no election. They had no representation in Parliament. So they didn't have a whole lot of ways of working through the peaceful system back then.
Wow. Now, you've spoken about every country has some law on treason, etc. How is ours more distinctive, different than any of these others, in your opinion? Is ours even enforceable? Because you've said that in the last 250 years, one person has been convicted of or been accused of treason, and only one conviction. That's sort of
One person has been executed under federal law since the Constitution. A couple people under state law, actually John Brown and Edwin Coppock, the raiders at Harper's Ferry, were executed under state law for Virginia. But as a general matter, yeah, there's been very few treason convictions in our history, which on balance I think is a good thing. I mean, the more that you have in a country, that means probably things aren't going well, which doesn't mean that it didn't happen, right? I mean, you think about the Civil War. You had every member of the Confederate Army, every person who aided that army had committed treason. But of course, we didn't actually try them or prosecute them. Now, I admit I do not know in detail the treason law of every country in the world. But I do think that what's distinctive is our constitutional definition of that. And that is that it's written in this 18th century language and that we can't really modify it short of amending the Constitution itself. And perhaps one of the most distinctive parts of it is not just the definition, but the two witness requirement. So you have to have two witnesses to the same overt act. So that means two people who saw you do it. Well, that's going to be pretty hard for a lot of crimes, particularly if they're committed, say, on a computer, right? If what you did was launch some type of, you know, cyber attack on the country and you just did it from your computer, how are you going to get two witnesses to that particular offense? It's going to be very hard. And so that's an area where arguably the 18th century Constitution doesn't quite mesh with modern realities.
Now, if you could rewrite the Constitution, how would it be written?
Well, and there's a lot of things that I would
rewrite. The Constitution.
There's a lot that I would rewrite. I mean, I think the two I would most rewrite, of course, would be getting rid of the Electoral College and abolishing equal state representation in the Senate. I actually don't have a problem with two senators per state. I have a problem with equal votes per senator. I would give the senators the number of votes proportional to their population. Let them still have two per state, and they can each, you know, interact in committees and do all that. That's fine. The problem is equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, but I realize that's probably not going to happen.
But you know that you gave, you know, I've been arguing, not to interrupt you, I just want to mention this because you brought this up. I've been arguing about that the two senators makes absolutely no sense. But again, we know that from the inception of this country, we weren't always looking for true democracy. But that said, I like your idea as far as, you know, still have two senators, but your vote is proportional.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of preserves a little bit of this kind of historic function of the Senate and you know, allows it to fit more engagement. Now, the problem is Article 5 of the Constitution says you can't have any amendment that alters the equality of suffrage in the Senate. And so that seems to say that even if we tried to amend the Constitution that way, we couldn't do it. And that's really interesting. And when I think about this, you know, part of me thinks, okay, well, how long is this going to last? Is this going to last for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years? We're still going to have absolute equality in the Senate despite, you know, massive changes potentially in population? Doesn't there become some point at which it just doesn't make sense anymore? And then how do we know we're not at that point now?
Professor Larson, you just confused me a bit. Are you telling me that there's a part of the Constitution that specifically says it cannot be amended?
Yeah, so I'll read it out to you. It's Article 5. It says, provided that no amendment can be made, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Does that then mean that that states could consent of changing the Constitution in that regards, or what?
Well, a state could actually consent to not having equal representation in the Senate, and that's sort of an interesting thing. You could imagine, well, what if you offered a state, you know, lots of money?
Right.
Might they choose to give up equal representation in the Senate? So in theory, yeah, a state could waive their rights, but it's hard to imagine a situation where any state would actually do that.
But in waiving those rights, it still would be unconstitutional to codify that into the Constitution.
That's, if you read Article 5 that way, it seems to say you can amend the Constitution every way you want, except in this one particular way.
Wow.
But then you say, well, why can't you just amend that part of the Constitution? Or alternatively, what you could do is you say, okay, fine, we keep equal representation in the Senate, but we're creating a new body called the Schmenet. And in the Schmenet, it's going to be based on population. And a bill can go either from the House to the Senate or from the House to the Schmenet. And that way, we have actually complied with Article 5, because the Senate still is equal, you know, votes per state. But in the Schmenet, it's going to be different. So, you know, in theory, you could do that.
Professor, you are a lawyer.
Yes, I am a lawyer.
You are a lawyer. All right, we are coming close to our time. So this is what I ask every person that comes onto the show. What have I not asked you that you would have loved if I had asked you and that you want to tell the audience?
All right, well, let me just tell you one story from the book. And this was something I just came across a year or so ago, and I had no idea of this story. No treason scholar had ever written about it. And it's the story of the one person who was actually executed for treason against the United States under federal authority. And this man was a Mexican man named Hipólito or Polo Salazar. And it happened during the Mexican-American War when American forces invaded what was the Mexican region of New Mexico. And they announced that, well, New Mexico was now part of the United States. It was, everybody living there was now an American citizen, and anybody who resisted the American military was guilty of treason against the United States. Now, that's completely wrong. You don't just become American citizen because the American army conquered you, right? I mean, if that were true, everybody in Iraq in 2003 would have suddenly been an American citizen. I mean, it's just absurd. So there's clearly wrong as a legal matter. But some people resisted, and some of them were put on trial, and one of them, Mr. Salazar, was convicted of treason against the United States and hanged in the plaza at Taos, New Mexico. And this was a man who spoke no English. He was a Mexican citizen. The trial was held in the Republic of Mexico, and he died as a traitor to the United States, a country in which he had never, ever set foot. This is as bad of a legal screw-up as you could possibly imagine. And when news of this reached Washington, members of Congress were absolutely appalled. The James Polk administration ultimately had to concede that it had screwed up, that this was rested on a legal mistake. They said he was a bad guy, so he should have been hanged for something else. But they had to concede that, yes, technically, he wasn't guilty of treason. And so that is the one person who has paid the ultimate price under our treason law. Not an American, but a Mexican. And I found that story just sort of absolutely extraordinary.
Yes, extraordinary. No, no, absolutely so. Professor Carlton F. W. Larson, thank you so kindly for having been with us. He's the author of On Treason, A Citizen's Guide to the Law. You'll be able to find the book right under the blog post. And when we go live, it'll be there as well. Thank you so kindly for being with us. And you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. That was Carlton Larson, excellent professor. Anyhow, I want to bring you guys up to speed. I wrote the article on my newsletter today, and I posted it to Daily Coast title, I flew to D.C. to be with my daughter because our healthcare, a fraud on humanity. And here it goes, the essay. Our healthcare system is a disgrace. Unfortunately, too many believe we are stuck with it. Is that what you believe as well? Until most Americans realize that we are in the same boat, we will continue to get policies that fail us all. The leaders of our economic system tragically misinformed. It's in their interest to ensure factions are fighting each other as they use as a sort of distraction for us all. Now, what does that have to do with me flying to DC to be with my daughter? Our healthcare system is the outcome of fraud. A fraud on humanity that came to pass from misinformation and factionalization techniques. Look, my daughter is in her fourth year at medical school at Howard. She had a stroke in January, the second half of her third year. It was completely unexpected. It turns out that she had a vascular malformation in her brain. She lost her vision, half of her vision, and her left side was somewhat compromised. Now, let's get to the present. My daughter sent me a text that scared me to death that had me on a plane immediately. Her malformation was zapped with radiation from a cyber knife in April. They told her she had the possibility of, after the vessel collapsed, that there may be some deficits that would develop. Well, it seems like that's what was starting to occur. Well, she said when she told us that she could not use her hands easily or put her tie, her shoelace, etc., it was time for me to get to hell to DC to take care of my daughter. Anyway, Ashley tried to make an appointment with a neurologist. Her plan has only two in the DC area. The best appointment date that she got was the end of December. Of course, they tell you if you have an emergency, go to emergency room, go to the emergency room. There are a lot of standalone high price emergency rooms that are available at a very high price. Remember that. But at the hospitals, we know what's going on. Pre-COVID, the emergency rooms were busting at the seams. And guess what? Post-COVID, they're exploding at the seams. Look, I am sure slack space with neurologists occur in this city, but our for-profit health system creates a false scarcity to maximize profits for shareholders and high-paid executives. They create fiefdoms of profit at the expense of the health of us all. It is not hard to understand that for-profit healthcare does not make things more efficient. In fact, the opposite is true. Doctors must hire staff to work the inefficiencies of using multiple insurance players, etc. Doctors operating in their own networks create inefficiencies by not opening all specialties for access to all. That would have allowed a government to determine where incentives are needed to encourage specialties where needed. In our current system, this is impossible. Maximizing profits means creating a false scarcity, and that is exactly what corporations do. Many Americans don't see healthcare as a right until it touches their loved ones. We are a rich country. We are a rich country that can afford great healthcare if the money in our current healthcare system actually went towards healthcare. Our system is an evil we have been taught to live with and accept. This is the best we can do? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I made a promise even before my daughter got her stroke. I saw too many of our citizens hurting because of our inhumane healthcare system. I will use the rest of my life to tell the truth, to inform in as humble a form as I can to as many as I can. The buildings are beautiful. When you look at those hospitals, they're beautiful. When you look at the clinics, they're beautiful. The facade is great. But ultimately, it is a system intended to bleed us dry, not provide firstly. We still have a democracy. When best informed, we can force our politicians to do the right thing and to get to hell, get the profiteers the hell out of there. Well, after writing that, I got a response. This was a Daily Kos. I got a response from a doctor. And anytime I get a response from a doctor, I get a bit concerned because a lot of times doctors have bought into the system the way it is. Now, my sister's a doctor. That's not how she believes. But this physician really made my day. Let's go ahead and say what he had to say. This is what he said. I am a physician and could not agree more. Our system of sickness profiteering perversely incentivizes lucrative treatments, not effective treatments. The cluster, and he wanted to say dirty, the cluster, you know what, dirty word. That is us, healthcare. A more apt moniker would be sickness exacerbation, allows middlemen to profiteer off of an ever more Byzantine and inscrutable cluster, you know what. I just spent 4 hours on the phone yesterday with support staff from my electronics medical record system trying to figure out how to bill for telemedicine and be paid fully. I had to download it 28-page cheat sheet of rules because they are different for each payer. This is madness and another version of American exceptionalism. Yeah, it's a terrible thing to be exceptional in this manner. I should note that I was finally so burnt out by this system that I have just moved to Costa Rica to eventually work in the much better healthcare system. And let me stop right there to tell folks, Costa Rica has one of the better healthcare systems in the country, actually. Everybody has access to healthcare. It is unheard of for anybody to go bankrupt because they've gotten sick. And they're a very healthy nation. And guess what? A lot of people from around the world go ahead and they move to Costa Rica because it's a beautiful place right next to my country of birth, Panama, which also has a form of socialized medicine. It's known as El Seguro Social. But so we have to really start thinking out of the box and start forcing to ensure that the things that we really need in society gets done. Anyhow, I should note that I was finally so burnt out by this system, says the doctor, that I have just moved to Costa Rica to eventually work in this much better healthcare system. I have to keep dealing with the US because a bunch of my patients, some of whom I have been seeing monthly for over a decade, could not bear the idea of finding another doctor after their harrowing experience prior to finding me. Given that I saved many of these people's lives by getting them off the opioids being fed to them daily at the encouragement of the legal opioid cartel, I too could not bear to leave them. So I fight on for them. I hope someday to be a part of a team that revamps our system that can never happen. He said a few dirty words in there, but I can understand the angst of this particular doctor. Folks, good healthcare is not difficult to comprehend. It's not difficult to understand at all. And that is one of the things that is why so many invest so much in misinforming folks. Government control of your healthcare. I use an example all of the times, and I always like to use the example of slavery. And the reason I like to use the example of slavery is because my contention is that our economic system has become so effective, so powerful, that it no longer has to enslave people with chains. It no longer has to differentiate between people so that we can classify who are slaves and who are not. We are much better at that. The fact that we are fighting about whether we should have some sort of an integrated social medical system as opposed to this private system that kills shows how the minds of many are so enslaved. And let me explain. And by the way, it's not a pejorative, because at some point in my life as well, I considered myself a slave to the system as well. Here's what I'm talking about. People always say they want choice. They want choice. That's the reason why they don't want a single payer system. That's the reason why they don't want Medicare for all. And the way they sell that to you, the way the corporations sell that to you, that the reason that you must have your choices between insurance companies, it is no different than asking a slave which White House they want to work for. Which master they want to work for. Do you want Master 1, Master 2, or Master 3? The thing about the master is all of them have the same whip. All of them are going to control you. All of them have taken away your liberty. Let's start giving you the examples. Okay, you have Cigna, you have Blue Shields, or whoever else you want to call you want to call it, okay? It doesn't matter what you want to call that. But think about that. What is happening here? You choose one particular insurance company. They tell you what drugs, what doctors, what network, and all these items that you can use. In other words, you said you wanted choice. You wanted choice of under whose slavery conditions you want. You go to Aetna. Aetna tells you you can use this doctor, you can take these medicines, or you can take that. You go to Universal. Universal tells you which ones of these things you can take. You don't have a choice of your particular doctors. But if you decide to leave the plantation, you're on your own, and we will make sure that the amount that you have to pay will bankrupt you. So we have complete control over you. That is what the corporations, that is what the media, that is what they would like to tell you is your choice. These are the choices you have. Are they really choices? Or is it which plantation you want to work for? I really need you to look at it in that form. Because we are of marketing country. We go ahead and we teach, we market things. We market just about everything. And if we really want to understand the enslavement that marketing that is true on us, we have to start with healthcare. Healthcare has nothing to do with, our healthcare system has very little to do with your health. It's first a product. It's first a product to be from which to make profit. And your health is just the raw material. And if it's your health that gets better, fine. If it's your, if you get sicker, fine. It does not matter. I mean, there are good doctors out there, don't get me wrong. But doctors are not the healthcare system. The healthcare system is the conglomerate of shareholders and executives and the people who decide if this hospital will live or die, if you will get the products that you need or not. Alternatively, the real choice, the system that gives you the real choice, is Medicare for All. In other words, a single payer system. We tell you, those doctors went to school and they own their own practices. And, you know, later on, we may want to fund doctors 100% if they promise to work in a system for maybe 10, 15 years. We'll pay your entire way. But what we're trying to say, in the Medicare for All system, you go ahead and you can go ahead and go to any doctor you want. Any medicine that they decide is best for you, without having to go through the calculations that those individual insurance companies had to go through to manage their risk. Because the reason why they have you in a network, the reason why they select the drugs you can take, the reason why they select the doctors is because, and the reason why they select their patients or their consumers, their customers, is because they want to ensure that they keep a particular profit margin based on the profile they've made of the people they have. And that is evil, because they have partitioned our American population into profit centers and nothing more. And when we understand that, we would have won the battle. Okay, let me go ahead and start telling folks, please remember to consider getting my book. My book is called, and let me put my book on the screen again. I took it off of the screen and I'm working with several computers here, so sometimes it gets a little hazy. It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relatives, Friends, and Neighbors. And here is the link for the book. I'm going to put that link in there. Please consider getting the book. By doing so, you are supporting our show. You're supporting Politics Done Right and sending this information throughout the country. Likewise, please, if you're listening to us on YouTube, please consider hitting that join button. Join us. Help us relay the message as we need to tell the message. Why? Because most people are informed by those who have an interest in informing them in a particular manner. Help us do the job. Hit that join button. It's very inexpensive to support us. Hit the join button. Become a part of our posse. If you're listening to us on YouTube, Twitch, or Facebook Live, you can go ahead and go to, I'm putting the other link in there, politicsdoneright.com/YouTube, politicsdoneright.com/YouTube. You can also go ahead and provide us assistance via PayPal. You go to politicsdoneright.com/PayPal. That is politicsdoneright.com/PayPal. And if you become a patron, there's a whole lot of little gimmies, goodies, all that good stuff to join us if you become a patron of Politics Done Right. Patron is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, that is politicsdoneright.com/patron. But again, folks, we need your support in every form that you can provide us, whether it's through our super chats, by hitting that dollar sign, clicking on the join button to become a part of the family, the YouTube family, become it, going on Patreon by going to politicsdoneright.com/patron, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, or going to politicsdoneright.com/PayPal. Look, my name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. Wait a minute. I can't leave without acknowledging all my peeps. What's wrong with me? Linda E., welcome to Politics Done Right. Bridge MCP, welcome to Politics Done Right. Michael Rudnin, welcome to Politics Done Right. AVQ, welcome to Politics Done Right. Let's see who else is here. Tank28, welcome to politicsdoneright.com. I'm scrolling down. Bear with me. We have a whole lot of messages in here. So you know how that goes. I don't like to leave anybody undeterred. But if I forget you or miss you, I'll get you the next time. AvenQ. Let's see. Going down. I'm coming. June Littler, welcome aboard. Bruce Pollard, welcome aboard, my brother. Let's see. Congratulations, you've received 100 messages. Thank you guys for giving me over 100 messages today. And I'll scroll back down to the bottom to see who else I missed. WF 4174, welcome aboard. I saw a lot more up top, so bear with me as I scroll down. As I scroll down, I never miss my peeps, you know that. Let's see. Wow, Tank 28 was pretty. Masticator, welcome aboard. Let's see who else. Masticator is has a bone with me. He thinks I'm some crazy guy. Lawrence Sims, welcome aboard. Who else is here? Lawrence Sims. Brian Miner, welcome aboard. Jacoby G, welcome aboard. Wow, a bunch of folk. Let's see. Who stole my name on Twitch? E. Willies, welcome aboard. Let's see. Brahaha, welcome aboard. And I think I'm almost near the top. I will scroll. I just missed a couple. So if I missed you, forgive me. I'm going to scroll down to the bottom again. I think I got everybody. You're in DC with daughter. You're allowed it. But, well, thank you very much for remembering that, Bridge MC Peep. Now, folks, look. We need to get busy. We need to get things done. And we are going to get things done with your help. By the way, everything that we're doing here, this is you doing it. That is where we, that is how we get the social network to actually start to foment change. So thank you so kindly. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics Done Right. And you know how I end this, baby. I am what? We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.